This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The first Chinese woman known to come to the United States arrived as part of a museum exhibit in New York City in 1834. As late as 1850, there may have been fewer than 50 Chinese people in the whole United States. 150 years later, the 2000 census reports that 3 million Chinese Americans now reside in this country. In her new book, author Iris Chang tells the story of how Chinese Americans arrived in the United States, why they came, and their contribution to American society and culture. Often, it's a story of racism, exploitation, and xenophobia. But she argues, a story of great dreams and great accomplishments, too. In short, an American story. Iris Chang is best known for her book, The Rape of Nanking, which was about the mass rape and massacre in that Chinese city by Japanese troops during the Second World War. Her grandparents were survivors. And she tells us a little about her own experiences, along with hundreds of others, in The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. Later in the program, we'll talk about two big issues in the United States Senate as Democrats propose an alternative to President Bush's tax cuts and Republicans denounce the filibusters blocking two judicial nominees. But first, the Chinese in America. If you know about the history of the Chinese in America and or have interesting personal stories, give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We'd like to hear about your family's history and take questions about the Chinese experience in America. Iris Chang is with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you.
This is an epic subject. What made you decide to write about it?
Well, all my life I was concerned about the stereotypes of the Chinese in the media, stereotypes that flattened us into these one-dimensional cartoon characters, Fu Manchu, Charlie Chan, Suzy Wong stereotypes, and I thought it was time that an honest history about my people was written.
One of the fascinating things about your book is that you tell us not only about the Chinese experience in America, but what was going on in China that led people to take that incredibly difficult decision to leave where they had always been and take that journey across the Pacific Ocean.
That's correct. And I describe in my book three major waves of immigration from China, each propelled by economic and political forces in that country. The first wave came in the mid-19th century, largely because there was so much corruption under the Qing dynasty, and also because many of the Chinese men came here to seek gold during the California Gold Rush. The second wave came as a result of the 1949 Communist Revolution, and the third wave started after China opened up to the West after the Mao years.
There's a nursery rhyme that you quote at the end of the first chapter of your book, and I'll take a shot at it. I'm sure I wouldn't do it as well as you. Swallows and magpies flying in glee, greetings for New Year. Daddy has gone to Gold Mountain to earn money. He will earn gold and silver, 10,000 taels. When he returns, we will build a house and buy farmland. Taels, of course, are a Chinese currency at the time. But that tells a great deal about why people left and what they expected when they got there.
Yes, in fact, like many other immigrants, the Chinese who came did not anticipate that they would often stay as long as they did. Many thought it was just a temporary visit. They'd make a fortune, then go back home. And
streets lined with gold,
that's
of course.
Right. Yeah. And often what they found was something entirely different. But the interesting aspect of Chinese American history was that during the 19th century, the American dollar was worth so much in China that Chinese workers could labor away in menial jobs, send remittances back to their families and home villages in China, where they could live like aristocrats. They could build palatial mansions. And so you had a sense of Chinese who would come here and they would not be able to return because the remittances would benefit their families so greatly.
Before the Chinese arrived in San Francisco and California, miners, 49ers, would send their laundry to Hong Kong.
Oh, that's right. White men during the California Gold Rush didn't want to do their own laundry and they couldn't find enough women to do it for them. And so they would actually ship their laundry to Asia to have it done. It would take 4 months for the laundry to get back. And eventually many of the early Chinese men in this country and in California saw a potential market, and they stepped in and filled it as laundrymen.
One of the great first contributions the Chinese made to this country, I think many people do know about it. It was the construction of the Union Pacific's part of the Transcontinental Railroad.
Absolutely. The Chinese worked for the Central Pacific and helped build the railroad across the mountains and plains of America. And during the process, not many people realized that three Chinese men would die for every 2 miles of track laid for the railroad.
And there was this peculiar duality, and I guess the first experience of the Chinese of this, where they were doing work that nobody else would do. They were brought in as cheap labor. On the other hand, when they did it well, they were held up to criticism.
Yes, because soon they were threatening white men's jobs. It's interesting to note that during the economic depression of the 1870s, suddenly the Chinese were demonized in the media and they were vilified because Chinese capitalists and wage earners were posing a very strong economic threat to the white men of the era. And this all eventually led to the Chinese Exclusion Acts.
And the Chinese were prohibited from coming to the United States.
Absolutely. For decades, the Chinese laborers could not come to this country, but Chinese scholars and diplomats and other classes could.
This was the era of the Yellow Peril.
Absolutely.
And one of the curiosities, though, is that because Chinese weren't white, and they had to be defined somehow. And so this led to a series of legal cases and some of the first cases of a great deal of activism that the Chinese have participated in.
No question of it. One thing that surprised me as I was researching this book was the degree to which the Chinese were politically active, even as early as the 19th century. They were extremely litigious. They fought for their rights. And in the process, their struggle laid down the foundation for civil rights law. The famous case Wong Kim Ark versus U.S. helped protect the right of birthright citizenship in this country. In other words, people born in this country are entitled to U.S. citizenship even if their parents are illegal aliens and not eligible for naturalization.
Our guest is Iris Chang. Her new book is The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And that first wave, of course, as you mentioned, obviously came in for the most part in California. But there were oddities in other parts of the country. Tell us the story of Cheng and Eng.
Cheng and Eng Bunker, yes. They were the famous Siamese twins, the ethnic Chinese men who were born connected together. They shared a liver and also a 5-inch ligament of flesh that connected their torsos. And they were world celebrities touring the country, touring the U.S. and also across the globe. And they eventually decided to retire and settle down in the American South. What was intriguing about them was that when they went to the South, they found great acceptance there. They married white women. They fathered 21 children between the two of them and also owned their own plantation, complete with 33 black slaves. And I bring this up because I believe that the exotic and strange appearance of the Bunker twins was really not enough to generate racism. It was only in regions where the Chinese, the large numbers of Chinese, posed a huge economic threat that they received a backlash.
And indeed, their two eldest children enlisted in the Confederate Army.
Absolutely. They fought during the Civil War. And Cheng and Eng Bunker were almost impressed into the Union Army when they came through the area, but they drew lots to see who would be forced into the military, and one was chosen, one wasn't. And confronted with that situation, they let both of them off.
That's the first wave of immigration we've largely been talking about here. The second wave fled for political reasons as the communists came to power in China after the Second World War.
Yes, a few people, mostly capitalists, the high-ranking nationalist officials, they came to the United States directly around 1949. But the vast majority of people who fled from China during that time went first to Hong Kong or Taiwan, and then later either they or their children would come to the United States, typically to study at American universities or to start new careers here. And that's part of the second wave of Chinese immigration, one of the great brain drain waves of immigration history.
And it is this wave that gives rise to what has subsequently been described as the model minority stereotype.
Yes, because of this wave emerged Nobel laureates and people who would make tremendous contributions to science and technology. For example, you have M.C. Chang, who co-invented the birth control pill and pioneered the field of in vitro fertilization. This wave also includes I.M. Pei, the world-famous architect, and also Ang Wang, the computer mogul who helped pioneer much of the computer technology.
And this is in part your story, too.
Yes, very much so. My parents were actually part of the second wave because my grandparents fled from China as a result of the Communist Revolution. And my parents grew up in Taiwan and later, after graduating from National Taiwan University, came to the United States on scholarship to receive their doctorates from Harvard University, and then settled down as professors, my father in physics, my mother in biology, in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, at the University of Illinois at Urbana. This story is quite typical of people of my parents' generation.
Let's go to the phones. Our number again, 800-989-8255, and John joins us from Belmont, Michigan.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'm actually calling probably a bit early in the conversation here, but I thought I'd mention something that I don't know if the third wave would necessarily constitute, but I guess it would be a ripple or fourth wave of adopted Chinese children into America, say like the late 90s to early 2000s.
Actually, my book addresses that phenomenon, the adoptions of Chinese babies, mostly little girls, by American couples.
I have two sisters who are adopted. We adopted them in, it was 89, or 1998, rather. I apologize for that. And I just thought it was an interesting concept. I can take an answer off the air.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks very much for your call, John. You say, I think the number you cite, if memory serves, 33,000?
Yes, and actually the number is growing as it becomes ever more popular.
And you also cite an irony. These are children the Chinese government, at least, does not want.
Well, because of the one-child policy, many families can only have one child in China. And because of centuries of sexism and the weight of that tradition, many families would prefer to have a son as their only child, not a daughter. And therefore, Chinese orphanages since the 1980s started filling up with Chinese girls who were unwanted. Many were abandoned, often by the side of the road, or sometimes they would be hidden away in the homes of relatives, but they weren't really supposed to exist. And while this was happening, there was also the rise of infertility within the United States, and many professional couples found themselves looking to adopt children overseas. And China has some of the most lenient policies for adoption. Many other countries have very stringent rules concerning who could adopt, and they have also very strict age requirements.
We're speaking with author Iris Chang about the Chinese-American experience. Her new book is The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. When we come back from a short break, we'll also take more of your calls. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, if you'd like to send us one, is totn@npr.org. Other headlines we're following today, an update on Iraq later. Oil in the north of the country is flowing now, and there is an outbreak of cholera in the southern city of Basra. Those stories, plus the latest from Scott Simon in Baghdad later today on All Things Considered. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Iris Chang about the history of the Chinese in America. If you have a story about the Chinese experience in America, perhaps something you can contribute to her history, you're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we go right to a caller? Det joins us from Pendleton, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Neil. First-time caller. I used to work for the Pendleton Underground Tours, and I was fascinated with your conversation. I was wondering if the caller, if she talks about in her book any of the history of the Chinese underground.
Well, actually, I remember that there was a bit of controversy about the Pendleton Underground Tours, that some people were questioning the authenticity of this. But for many years, there were rumors that there were underground tunnels beneath the American Chinatown, especially in San Francisco and New York, and real lurid stories would emerge of the Chinese engaging in white slavery and keeping white women in bondage in these tunnels, opium dens.
Opium dens, I was about to throw
right.
that in there, yes.
And then the earthquake of San Francisco revealed that there were no such tunnels. So this was a sore spot for many Chinatown residents who felt that their community was being unfairly portrayed.
Yeah, and I also heard about the tours up in Seattle. I actually never went on that tour myself, but I was also hearing about some of the history of the Chinese up in the Seattle area.
Mm-hmm. There are tours, of course, for Chinatowns across the country, and I would think that they vary greatly depending on who's conducting them.
Det, thanks very much for the call.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate it. Here's an email from Forrest Swartout. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. My grandfather, a Chinese man from the Guangzhou area, was the personal valet for the U.S. Brigadier General from 1944 to 1946. For his services, he was able to become a naturalized citizen. Could Iris Chang please discuss about the Chinese who served in the U.S. military?
Oh, absolutely. I think there isn't much awareness in this country of the Chinese-American contribution during World War II, and it was a very substantial one when you consider that 1 in 5 Chinese-Americans in the continental U.S. during World War II actually served in the American Armed Forces.
1 in 5?
Yes, 1 in 5, because the population was so predominantly male and single during that time, thanks to the exclusion laws. And also just the immigration pattern of men coming to this country and leaving their wives back at home, and they were really often the first ones drafted, and so it was 20% of the population at the time, and at the same time, not only do they serve in the U.S. military, often with great distinction, but there was a tremendous amount of Chinese-American activism during that time. They helped raise money for the war effort, and they tried to publicize the reality of the Japanese invasion in mainland China during that time. Some held demonstrations at the docks to prevent the shipment of scrap metal to Japan, and their activism combined with the activism of other groups, eventually led to Roosevelt's decision to place an embargo on the sale of these war materials to Japan, which preceded the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, many people don't realize, from the American point of view, it's hard to understand that the Japanese invasion of Manchuria began in 1937, and the Chinese army throughout the Second World War was much more deeply involved in China than ever it was in the Pacific theater.
There's a real void in the public consciousness about the whole Pacific arena of World War II. Japan's invasion of China and many years of undeclared war in China ultimately killed an estimated 35 to maybe 19 to 35 million Chinese people, and millions more across Asia. And I think only now is attention starting to turn towards this these forgotten atrocities.
And your book, your earlier book, The Rape of Nanking, people forget that incidents like the famous Doolittle raid, where bombers took off from an aircraft carrier, and everybody, I think, remembers that part, but they landed in China, and most of those flyers, the American flyers, got away with the help of the Chinese people, but there were tremendous reparations foisted on the Chinese people by the Japanese.
Oh, that's right. In fact, I had the privilege of meeting some of the Doolittle raiders at a reunion that was in California just a few weeks ago, and they were, you know, smuggled out of the country with the help of many of the Chinese villagers. I also had the opportunity to meet some of the villagers who actually had suffered great retaliation from the Japanese for their help in assisting these Doolittle raiders. Some had the rotten leg disease because of the Japanese anthrax attacks on those villages. There are estimates of about 250,000 Chinese people killed in retaliation for their help in the Doolittle raids. It's just amazing. And the story of the biological warfare that the Chinese endured from the Japanese as a result of their help in the Doolittle raids is a story that still needs to be told.
Let's go now to James, who joins us from Irvine, California.
Yeah, hi. My question relates to whether any of the descendants of the original wave of Chinese Americans who were affected by the Chinese Exclusionary Acts, whether those defendants have sought reparations against the U.S. government, much as other certain minority groups have, such as the Japanese Americans interned during World War II. And what are your thoughts of seeking such reparations, if none have been sought?
I'm not aware of any kind of political movement to seek reparations, and the interesting thing is that some of the descendants of the early Chinese from the 19th century whom I've interviewed do not even look recognizably Chinese. Many of them look Caucasian or African American or Native American Indian, and so I'm not aware of such a movement. I do know, however, that there is legislation pending to give U.S. citizenship posthumously to those Chinese who fought during the Civil War and who they were later denied citizenship during the Exclusion Era. And that legislation apparently has been proposed.
That's the U.S. Civil War, obviously.
U.S. Civil War. There were at least 50 Chinese Americans who fought during that time.
James?
Ms. Singh, what are your thoughts of the descendants, whether they look Chinese or not, whether they have any basis to obtain reparations, monetary or otherwise?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think it's one that would deserve a great deal of exploration and also thought on my part, because there's no question that that many of the early Chinese, especially during the period of the Exclusion Era, were terribly mistreated, and some of them were massacred, actually, in American cities and small towns across the American West. And the families of those Chinese who were slaughtered were not compensated for that. And it was a period known as the driving out era. It started in the 1870s and 1880s, and hundreds of people would lose their property and their lives. And it's not something very well known in American history. So I think that it's definitely something that needs to be examined carefully.
James, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Email we've got from Deborah. A 50-year-old friend, she has a last name, I'm not going to try to pronounce it. A 50-year-old friend of mine whose parents are Chinese immigrants recently found to her astonishment that she has a Caucasian grandmother. What happened was that her great-grandfather came to California in the early 20th century to work in San Francisco, married a Caucasian woman, then took her back to China with him. Is this type of intermarriage unusual, or is it a hidden part of our history?
It's not unusual at all. I mean, one thing that struck me as I did my research was the prevalence of interracial marriage, often between the Chinese immigrants during the 19th century with white women, black women, or Native American women. In fact, in New York City during the 19th century, interracial marriage between Irish women and Chinese men was so common that such marriages were mocked on the stage and caricatured and lampooned in cartoons. And so it's really something that's a very rich part of the Chinese-American experience and not yet very well known.
Let's go now to Terrence, who's on the line from St. Louis.
Yes, hi, Neil. I'm glad to call. It's the first time I got you. I used to listen all the time with Juan Williams.
Okay.
And Ms. Chang, it's nice to hear from you.
Thank you.
I'm an African-American male, and my wife, her great-great-grandmother was from Manchuria, the area.
Mm-hmm.
And they came here in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother is actually, around 1937, escaped from, I believe, what the Japanese occupied, the area.
Mm-hmm.
And she got here. And what I really wanted to say is that they've had a history of dealing with being in the African-American neighborhoods and opening up stores and cleaners and actually Chinese food restaurants. And they're pretty well off. And what I was wondering is, how prevalent is that within the society? Because I've noticed a lot of they're very racially okay, but a lot of them are not. They don't accept the black side of the family as much as if the side was Caucasian or white. And it seems that there is really a racist thing going on at the same time when they're a minority in the country also. And I have also noticed, and I want to know if your book addressed how many different things that the Chinese Americans have contributed in relation to the black Americans who actually were helping them get along on the path of becoming the people they are today. And that's basically what I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks very much, Terrence.
Thank you.
If I might address the second part of the question, there actually was a great deal of cooperation between the Chinese-American community and the African-American community in some parts of the country during the Civil Rights Movement. Most notably, during the late 60s, when there was a push to establish ethnic studies departments in colleges like San Francisco State and the University of California at Berkeley, and Chinese Americans joined forces with African Americans and Native American Indians, Hispanic Americans, to form the Third World Liberation Front, which made it possible for the creation of many of these multi-ethnic curriculums, and that's how we have ethnic studies departments today. I would pretty much say that there has been a long relationship often between the two ethnic groups. It's just often not very well known or documented.
Well, what about the first part of his question on his impression, at least, that some Chinese seem to be more, Chinese married to African Americans, that the Chinese part of the family seems somehow exclusionary?
Well, I think it would vary from family to family. I mean, it's it really depends on the individual experience. But in the case of Chinese Americans, there are families I know who would also take offense if they married if their children married Caucasians or any other ethnicity outside of the Chinese race. So I think it really would depend on the family. I was very fortunate in that by growing up in a multi-ethnic community like Champaign, which was an academic community, I saw constantly professors marrying across color lines, and my own family was very open and welcoming when I married somebody who was Caucasian American and did not fight that and insist that I marry someone Chinese American. So I think it really depends. It depends on the individual family and their philosophy.
Our guest is Iris Chang, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go now to Jim, who's on the line with us from Tempe, Arizona.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I had a friend in college back in the 50s, early 50s, during the Red Scare era, University of Illinois. He was from China. He had gotten a master's degree in engineering, and he said that he was not allowed to return to his home in China because he had technical knowledge that the American government didn't want him to take back to communist China. Have you heard of that? Was that a problem? I always felt sorry for the guy.
Are we talking about somebody you knew or something you heard?
I knew him. He told me this.
Oh, well, it's interesting you mentioned this because my first book, Threat of the Silkworm, is a biography of Dr. Tsien Hu Shen, who was a victim of McCarthyism during the 1950s, and he ran into, I guess, similar trouble during, you know, during this period of Cold War hysteria.
There were 120 of those people, weren't there?
Yeah, yes, indeed. In fact, Dr. Tsien was a brilliant Caltech aerodynamicist and professor, and he also was a founder of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He designed some of this country's earliest missiles and made tremendous contributions during the war effort in the 1940s. But during the 50s, he came under accusations of being a communist and was stripped of his security clearance and was kept under virtual house arrest for about 5 years while the government was trying to decide what to do with him. Ultimately, they deported him to China after entering into secret negotiations with China to swap him for some American POWs who had been shot down during the Korean War as pilots. But the story describes how then after Tsien was deported to China, he then revolutionized the Red Chinese ballistic missile program.
And a lot of people have pointed out that his story seems to parallel the much more recent story of Wen Ho Lee.
Absolutely, it was like the Wen Ho Lee case of the 1950s. Only what's different is that he really was forced to return to China.
And the other thing it raises, of course, is the entire suspicion of double loyalties.
Yes, because many Chinese are viewed as perpetual foreigners, that no matter how much contribution they make to this country, they're still seen as suspect. And we see this time and again in my book, The Chinese in America. At various times, the Chinese are embraced, celebrated for their contributions, and they're accepted as honorary whites. And at other times, they are persecuted and even killed in extreme cases when there's an economic or political crisis or when Sino-American relations turn sour.
Jim, thanks very much for the call.
But you hadn't heard of numbers of people forbidden to return to China?
I think she mentioned that there were 120 of them in this category.
I recommend you read my book, Thread the Silkworm. It goes into that in great detail.
We just have a couple of seconds left, Iris Chang, but you also make the strong point that this is very much an American story.
Yes, I think it's a quintessential American story. It's a history of the United States, really, as seen through the perspective of one of its most successful and misunderstood minorities. And the Chinese struggle for their dreams, dreams of success, economic success, and democracy is very much also, I think, a story of that many Americans can identify with. It's definitely a struggle for American democracy.
Iris Chang, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Iris Chang's new book, The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. When we come back, Senators Tom Daschle and Craig Thomas will offer differing views of tax cuts and other issues in the Senate. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.